From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Welcome back to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 3, The Double Homicide. This week, Bob broke down the second crime scene in our case. The scene is confusing, to say the least, and this episode has drummed up a lot of questions. And for the first time this season, the gang is all here. So Bob, Janet, and I will do our best to get all your questions answered. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
We do. Janet will remind me if I get one of these wrong. But one is, if you're not on the live stream while we're filming this, because we're filming this recording this on Wednesday, and you're hearing it Friday, then it's already happening. But this Friday, August 1st, is the hearing for the West Memphis 3 case down in West Memphis, where they are hopefully going to be approving the evidence. I had a meeting about this today. As far as we know, we have an order. It was written by Sony Haygood, the DA down there, and Patrick Banca, who's Damien's attorney, has looked it over. It looks like it's good. So it's going before a judge. I hate to sound like a pessimist. I'm a little bit concerned in the fact that instead of this being just an order that's put before a judge to be signed, it's the same judge, by the way, that denied us 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that we're actually having like a full out hearing for it. It just, I don't know. I think it's, we've had the rug yanked out from us so many times that it's hard for me just to be real confident that something is going to happen. It concerns me that there's a whole hearing about it. So hopefully we don't end up in a situation where, you know, the prosecutor is saying, oh, I wrote the order. I'm on your side. And then the judge is the one that says no. I know that there's the family members of victims are invited. It's a whole hearing. So I will update you guys on that as soon as I have any information about it. And on that topic, scheduling wise, housekeeping, next week, I have to be out of town the entire week. I have to go to a conference for my other job, for my teaching job. I'm going to be in Detroit all week. I get to go to a Tigers game, so that's nice, but I'm going to be gone all week, so we can't do a follow-up. So we were going to just take that week was scheduled just to be a week off from the podcast, but we are going to give you guys some content. So for those of you that follow the Anand Syed case, as you guys know, the undisclosed Colin and Rabia did a series updating with a bunch of new information about that case. We've talked about some of that in our follow-ups. The last 2 weeks, which were the final 2 weeks of their series on Adnan, we have not talked about yet. And we've had a lot of people asking us to. So what we're going to do is, this Sunday, Janet and I at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, are going to live stream for our patrons a discussion about all these new undisclosed updates. So we're going to do a full episode about that. We may even see if we get any other guests that might pop in. No guarantees on that because I just thought of that literally just now as we're talking. But it's going to be a discussion about the Anand Syed case. It will be an episode that's going to drop for everybody, an audio episode, on Friday. So next week, when normally you would get a follow-up, you're going to get that episode that's going to come out. And again, for patrons, they can watch it live and participate in the chat on this Sunday. So that's going to be coming. And also, when we do that, I should know by Sunday, when we're doing that live stream, what happened in this West Memphis 3 hearing. So we'll be talking about that a little bit too during that discussion. So that's what's going to happen. So this week, you're hearing this follow-up on Friday. There is no episode on Sunday this week. Just the way it works for our, I don't like doing an episode and waiting 2 weeks for the follow-up. So instead of pushing, we're pushing this week's episode back to next week. So next Sunday, this is very confusing as I'm explaining it. No episode this Sunday. Next Sunday will be episode 4 of season 17, where we're going to be discussing some medical evidence. And on next Friday will be the Anand Syed and updates on the West Memphis 3 case. So that's it. And then now the last thing that for housekeeping is for any of you patrons, we have a ton of new patrons, which we really appreciate. For those of you, if you have not gotten on and explored the app, we did just add at the request of Valeria, one of our awesome patrons has been around for a long time. There's a new feature on Patreon. We have now added a community chat section on the Patreon app. So if you haven't been doing that, if you're a patron, go just open the app. If you hit the community page, there's three chats where we can all just like talk about whatever. There's one for the pregame, there's one for the episodes, and there's one for miscellaneous. It's just a way for the Patreon community to be able to all chit chat back and forth. So check that out. That being said, we need to get going, moving on to this episode. Hopefully both of you guys got on the website and looked at the diagrams and stuff, because this episode was I'll tell you, is a real difficult one to write because there were so many moving parts to it. What were your thoughts, Zach? I'll start with you.
This crime scene is confusing as hell. It's way more confusing than the first one. I mean, the first one, there's still, we have no idea what's happening, but this one for sure is confusing. The idea of there possibly being almost three locations in this crime scene is hard to wrap my head around. The idea of the car being moved, you know, and the thing that I was thinking about, and I actually walked it off when I got here today, is the fact that the car was moved about 100 feet.
Yeah.
That's really not very far. In the grand scheme of things, 100 feet is not very far. So I understand they're moving it to try to hide it, but it's still just...
So if you look at the diagram, that 100 or might have been 150 feet somewhere around there, you're right. It's not super far, but it's a world apart from as far as what people can see. So a car being right by the dugout, where we have blood there, we know something was going down there, is in direct view, if you look at the diagram and the map, from the houses right there on 14th Street, where when they pull back 150 feet, then they had a spot where they can, because there's like a little trail there where they could turn it back into the woods. And just by moving it that far, now it's out of sight. It's not visible. A car driving down the road wouldn't see it there. So I think that's, even though the distance wasn't that much, it's the angle, I think, more than anything.
Which totally makes sense after seeing it like that too. But it was just confusing to me that they would spend that much time with the body. The idea that there's no blood in that car, which comes around to having a second vehicle. But then something that I didn't see in any of the questions that is confusing to me is that there's possibly blood on the shingles that's under and behind the Tempo, which means if that body wasn't in that other car was parked very close to it.
Or at some point. And to be clear, the shingle pile spans under the car, but where the blood's at is not under the car. It's behind the car.
Yeah. I guess I was assuming that, but I just was thinking about logistics of how that blood would be by the car without there being blood in that car. Mm-hmm. So it's just very strange to me.
Yeah. My number one question, again, a lot of questions and just general sort of bewilderment. I appreciated your breakdown at the end. And I'm glad that I'm not the only person who wanted to know this, but you know, my biggest question was like, well, whose car is that?
That car that was left there?
Yeah.
It's a good question. We're going to get into that later when we get into when I go down and do a full breakdown beyond the trial evidence, because the car does not belong to Liz.
Right. I thought they walked to Elise and some other folks in our chat too, and the YouTube page were like, I'm sorry, in the Facebook page we all remembered you as having said that the ladies were going to walk to the liquor store.
If I said that, that's incorrect. Like they drove.
I don't know why we thought that. I mean, I thought that because this situation reminded me of a very scary thing that happened to me as a teenager. And I remember, maybe you somehow intuited what I was remembering if he didn't say walked, because what I thought was, oh my God, I also walked to a liquor store as a teenager in the middle of the night and had a very, very bad experience with like a predator. Certainly it was not this bad. And I don't know the circumstances of this, of course. That's part of the big mystery. But so the walking really stuck with me.
Yeah, I'm just saying if I did say that was incorrect. Like they walked out the door.
Yeah.
But then they left in a vehicle as far as we know. And that vehicle is registered for somebody. And that's why I need to dig deeper, because it was even asking Erica and I, we were talking about it last week. And I was like, whose car is this? Because I'm looking at the registration and stuff for the car and it doesn't belong to her. And she's like, it was like some random guy. It was never, as I said, one of the biggest problems with this case is there was no attention to the victimology whatsoever. Like that, and I got to dig deeper. Maybe somewhere in there it's answered. but it seems like it was a friend of Liz's whose car she was using, something like that. But yeah, it doesn't seem to be a question that was that has been readily answered yet. Hopefully something we can get to the bottom of.
Okay. Yeah. Colin definitely had a question about that person, who I guess I won't name here. I mean, I think he's named in the documents on the site, but I don't know. I don't know that we need to call him out at this point. Yeah. I mean, that. So and then we have some additional follow-up questions based on people looking carefully at the exhibits, the look of the car, anything that they can try to glean from those photographs to see if they can expound on what may or may not have happened around all this mystery.
Well, I'll tell you the one thing that I think all of us are thinking about that I don't know that I saw a question about either, that I know all of us are wondering about, is when the crime was called, when the scene was called in, it was called in for a car and a body.
Yeah.
And then the first responding officers seemed to be surprised.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
That's exactly why I said it the way I said it in the episode, because it's not like explicitly stated that they weren't looking for a body, but the way it's described by through the testimony is like, you know, we were looking, we found the car, and then we like noticed the body that this like park official found. And that was one thing that was one of those many questions that came to this episode was hard to write because I kept having to go back and try to retrace things down because it was like, wait a minute, it was called in as a body. Why were they surprised to find a body? And it doesn't say we were surprised to find the body. It's just the way he like broke it down out in the testimony. It seemed that way.
Yeah. And I guess based on our experience and our sort of wanting to look with careful eyes at statements that are made, especially if we start to be concerned that things are being manipulated to benefit a certain timeline or a certain story, a certain narrative. I guess that the question then is like, does it benefit their case in some way to have kind of been surprised by the body? I don't know why it would.
I don't think so.
It's just a weird random way of explaining it.
Yeah, because you got in this scene, there's no like direct evidence. It's not like the other scene where they got a 12-year-old boy who they can get to say, Chris did it, you know, and that was there in the house. Like this one, the bodies were found, you know, 12 hours later, and, you know, there was no witnesses or anything like that. So, like, there's no advantage to it. It's just this crime, both crime scenes were, Zach and I, that's why we were a minute late, well, you were too, but getting in here. Because we were out looking, trying to figure out like the layout of the crime scene of the house, even because it was like just the way they took the pictures, like everything is, and like there's no diagrams, like nobody like drew out a diagram to show like this is the layout. If you look on the website at the crime scene photos of the house, it's the same thing. It's like everything's up close, and we're just like, what am I looking at? And you're trying to piece from this picture to this picture to this picture to try to get how things are laid out, and it was the same thing, consistent. It was the same thing that we saw in this ball field scene where it's just like you don't get a good perspective of anything. I had to when I stepped away from the transcripts and like broke it down, like this is where things were laid out and tried to walk you through it and the diagram I created, that was from me going into Bertozzi's actual crime scene report where there was measurements and I was literally like on Google Earth, like taking like line measurements to see where stuff was at to get a better idea of it because it just wasn't, I just don't think it was investigated well. And I think part of that is because they, you know, they zeroed in on Chris, got him to give an incriminating statement and said, nope, that's it. We got it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm sure this will be a conversation that's very ongoing for this season, which is, you know, you've already laid it out there. This idea that Gary, Indiana has a high murder rate, a high crime rate, and that this is not necessarily, this doesn't seem like it could be a product of a lack of experience handling a homicide. So the questions that run through one's mind are, you know, is it that they had this specific person that they could zero in on soon? Or is it a sense of just not like feeling so overwhelmed always by having all of these crimes that crop up that you have to investigate that you just get sloppy? I don't know.
I wonder if there's like a happy medium where it's like, That's somewhere in the middle there where there's like the no crime communities where it's like they're just too inexperienced to handle it properly.
Yeah.
And then there's like places like Gary, who was the murder capital of the United States, where they just do so many of them that they just half ass. It's sloppy as the word you use, I think is a good word, where it's just like it's not significant enough that there was this homicide that they're putting real great care and effort into it. And if there's like a happy medium somewhere where it's like, if the investigations are better in an area where there are enough homicides that they have experience in the skill sets to do it properly, but not so many that they get lazy and sloppy about it. I wonder.
Well, and I think there may be a class situation too, where it's like, does a great, and I don't know the answer to this, I really hope that there are wonderful detectives who are really dedicated to keeping communities safe and solving crimes and living in an area that maybe isn't well known as being a place that you would necessarily want to raise your family unless you had to. Like, you know, cities get reputations, and it makes you wonder if, you know, a really great detective is kind of has their eye on the prize of like, well, if I could just transfer over to so-and-so, like that's a kind of a nicer place. I could get a nicer house. I mean, I don't know. And I'm not saying that I would be the person who's like, no, I'm dedicated. I'm a really good cop, and I'm really dedicated to helping people who are maybe marginalized or people who aren't, you know, aren't as fortunate as I happen to be or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. It's just a lot of questions. And I think if anything, carrying over from last season, I think everyone is like very aware of what the community itself and what the crime rate is and how it relates to poverty and things like that, then spill over into like the way the police conduct investigations and stuff. So I think like that ever that's kind of fresh in everyone's minds, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So we already addressed Colin and Elise, who had those questions about the car. Let's talk about Sarah's things that she kind of noticed about the car as well. She says, State Exhibit 67, image of car. If the car remained as found, there could have been a third person in that car. The front passenger seat is pushed forward like they would be letting someone out of the back seat. And then with State Exhibit 95, looking at that image of the car. Second, do we know how tall each woman is? The driver's seat appears to be very close to the steering wheel.
I don't know offhand, but that's, I'm just noting right here, something that I want to definitely take careful note of in our next upcoming episode is the height. And I'm looking at, she said State's Exhibit 67?
Yeah, 67 and 95 were two car images that she was pointing out.
Oh, yeah, so she's showing... That's a really good point. And this is all stuff that we're going to get into. Like I said, we're doing a full crime scene investigation where we're doing exactly what Sarah's doing here and like getting beyond the trial transcripts and seeing what we notice. Yeah. So I haven't really like done what she's doing, but I'm looking at. So what she's saying is this is a two-door car. And in that picture, the passenger side seat is pushed all the way forward, like the way you do when you need somebody to get out of the back seat. So that's super interesting because, yeah, that would indicate that there was a third person in the car.
Yep.
Yes, it could also indicate someone's looking for something in the back seat.
True.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, if the unsubs are trying to rob them, they move the car, then they start digging through that back seat. They have to move that seat. There very well could be a third person in that back seat,
right.
But there also could be that they were just rummaging in the back seat to try to find...
Definitely
something.
Yeah. And it's certainly something. So these are great point, Sarah. And that's something that we're definitely taking note of when we move into the crime scene investigation. Good catch.
Cool. Moving on to kind of a general question about the location, and then we can move into some other. I tried to sort of organize this by subject because you guys had such great questions. And in many cases, I tried to kind of combine people's questions so that we could hit a lot of the same points. But Lilia says, it sounds like Bob didn't necessarily think the two women were taken to the ballpark to be killed, but that they were killed when one tried to escape. But if we still think that they could have been taken there with the intention of murdering them, what do we know about this ballpark? Is it a place where one might commit a crime? Is it known to be an area where some sort of exchange might happen that's illicit or criminal in some way? Do we know anything about that?
Nothing that I've found so far, but again, those are on the list. As you guys are all asking great questions as we like move into further investigate. If you look on the map on the website, you know, the location doesn't seem like it's a great spot to go be conducting any kind of illicit activities because of the fact that, you know, most of the field is very clearly visible from the road. And, you know, it's wide open off of 14th Street. Idaho Street kind of like dives right into the ballpark. And then there's, you know, there's a couple houses, right? There's one house that's like looking right down the third base line out their front door. So, yeah.
You know how well lit it is, like streetlight wise, and how much of that would spill into the ballpark?
I'm looking at it on the Google Earth image right now, as far as, you know, using shadows to see where like light poles might be. I see what could be a light pole like up by the road. But nothing back toward, I don't see any indication that there's like light poles like back by the field. So that's a good question. Yes, yeah. It could be completely dark back there.
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely places like that. Like, for example, Tucson, where I'm from, is a dark city where they intentionally keep things very dark because there is an observatory. And there are pockets where the street itself is like decently lit. And like the second you step off the street into a park, it's pitch black. So I'm just curious, because you would get a sense of security like, oh, no one can see anything that's going on.
Yeah, that looks to be the case here. I'm guessing this is like a Little League field, or it looks a little deeper than a Little League field, maybe like a Pony League or Babe Ruth League field. But yeah, it's definitely a place where, you know, there's no games after dark because I don't see.
Yeah. And it is surrounded by a wooded lot more so than anything else in this map. So, I mean, if you're in this area, I don't know what the outside area looks like, but if you're in this area. I mean, that's where you're going to go if you're in this map area, because it's the only spot that's kind of secluded.
Right. And if you go on the website, if you go into the episode one folder, I put in some in the big picture one. I put some diagrams in like the whole city. There's one that's called the Both Scenes aerial, where it shows where things are at. And you can see. Yeah. So you have a very heavily populated area, you know, between the two crime scenes, the ball field, like it butts up against like the only big wooded area. In the whole vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Yeah. So it probably is a place where you could be out in the dark too. But then the other problem with that is you have an area across the street from a house that's normally pitch black. You pull in there at night with a car with headlights and taillights, it almost would stick out more.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Okay. Victimology, I'm sort of putting some of this is very also investigation centric, but Lilia says, any evidence the women actually made it to the liquor store? Do we know if they walked in, walked out? Any evidence of that at all?
This is all stuff that we're going to have to try to track down by trying to find witnesses and stuff. Because no, from what I've seen in the case file, there was no effort to figure any of that out. It was like the victims were not of any concern to the detectives in this case. It's like, oh, well, this guy confessed, so let's just convict him. And let's not worry about who actually killed them.
Yeah, well, that's the next question. I mean, Julie says, do we know any victimology? So that's kind of asked and answered, Julie. But Julie is saying, you know, what can we do about this? Do we have the opportunity to find out more from friends or relatives?
Yeah, so I now have contact information for Anthony Jeffers' son and Liz Ayers' son, or daughter. Daughter-in-law, actually, I think. So I've got contacts for two or three people now. And so that my intention is to start there by talking to them. I'll see if they'll interview, if they want to do an interview for the show, or if they just want to talk to me off the record, but they've agreed to talk to me. So we can start that process of learning about the victims. And then hopefully, you know, like one of the things I want to do is try to, you know, see if I can find the guy that owned that car and see what we can find out from him. There's a lot. This is going to be a case where we are going to have to be doing and our full-on investigation like we've done in past cases. And to that point, I want to remind everyone that you guys need to let us take those steps, and then we'll talk about it, so that we do not want any of our listeners going out on their own and reaching out and tracking down witnesses or reaching out to people or anything like that. I mean, besides the fact that, you know, we have a pretty careful approach to how we do it. I have also in contact with the lawyers that are working on the case. So like, I know if there's somebody, okay, we need to not talk to that person because maybe it's someone who might be using an appeal and they have somebody else talking to them. I know all that stuff, who we should and shouldn't reach out to. And then there's also, you know, if you approach a conversation like that the wrong way, it could sour the witness where they can't be used. Or it could stop them from communicating with somebody else, or it could be the way you discuss something, and then maybe then they give you information, but the way you prompted that conversation makes it so their testimony would become unusable. So just so please do not do that. Do not do that at all.
Yeah. Well, I'm I'm sure everyone's glad to hear that you sounds like you're going to be able to have some of those key conversations. I mean, with any case like this, I'm sure everyone is also big picture curious about whether the community feels that the right person is there. And, you know, when people recant things, is that information getting to victims' families? And does it, you know, like how many people embrace the idea that the wrong person is in prison versus just kind of accept and hope that the right person is, you know?
Yeah. And we'll find that out as we start talking to people in the community.
Caroline says, asking this in the least judgmental way possible. Thank you for your candor, Caroline. Is there any evidence that the two ladies were engaged in sex work of any kind? Any criminal history, drug use, toxicology reports? Was anything like that done in autopsies?
Yeah, there's toxicology reports we're going to be talking about in the autopsies and all the medical evidence. As far as again, there was no effort made to do any victimology on them. So we don't have a lot of those answers. I can give you this because some of this stuff's out in the public already. The state made the argument to fight against an appeal that they were sex workers to try to get away from and successfully navigate their way away from some evidence that came up in an appeal. And I'll also tell you that there is zero evidence that was presented that that's actually true.
Wow.
That they were sex workers.
All right. Juan says, did the police pull records of Liz's pager? Could the call that Liz got come from Suzanne's house phone?
Good question. No. Again, I know this is going to sound like a broken record, but again, no effort towards victimology whatsoever. No effort to find out what was actually happening. Like, you know, like I said, you know, Michelle testified at trial, and Michelle has since passed away, by the way, which is unfortunate because she would be probably one of our best witnesses.
That was one of the questions. Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, oh yeah, she had wrote the name Chris and a phone number. What was the phone number? Where's the paper? Where's the phone records? What number did she call? None of that. We got none of that.
Gosh, I mean, I'm sure I speak for everyone. Zach, tell me if I'm wrong, but this really makes you want to know as soon as possible what this confession is like, what the shape of that is going to be, and how compelling it would not or would be for everybody to go, oh, cool, we just got this wrapped up in a neat little package. Like,
well, and the idea that it came within 24 hours, it came within 24 hours of this is baffling to me.
So I'll address that while we're talking, because that's how we address how we're delivering the information this season. Because everything's so complicated, because everything's all over the place, because it seems like we know based on depositions and testimony later on that the narrative that was presented at trial is not true. I decided that the best way to approach this is for us without the bias creeping in of what those statements say happened. I want us to try to figure out our best theory on what did happen first, and at least have all the verifiable evidence in order. When, you know, what was the timeline? Mm-hmm. When did things happen? Who did what? You know, what was the medical evidence? All this. So at least we have all that information before we go in and see what the statements are. Because I think the reason that we have all these unanswered questions is I think this is what happened. They pull him in. They push Chris into giving these statements, and they're like, boom, there we do. We got the case closed. We can clear it. And then I think they pretty quickly figured out that, wait, that's impossible. And so instead of going, well, let's figure out what did happen then, it feels very much like they were like, well, let's not go looking for more evidence because any evidence we find is going to point away from him. So let's not do it. Like, oh, there's fingerprints on Liz's car. Let's see who they belong to. Let's test them against Chris. Nope, not his. I mean, I'm giving you a little bit of the forensics. There's more coming, but. So I was just on Bob Mata's stream talking about this case last week, and as I told him, it's like, do you know whose fingerprints were on the car? No, you don't. Neither did the jury, and neither did the state, because as soon as they find out they weren't Chris's, they didn't run them through APHIS. They didn't do anything to figure out who they did belong to. DNA, they didn't even test the DNA. There's lots of DNA evidence. They didn't even test it because they knew if that DNA evidence came back as not Chris's, that was not going to be great for the jury to hear, so they just didn't test it. What if that phone number was someone other than Chris? Well, we better not find out who the phone number was, because if it's not Chris, then that's going to ruin our case.
And so is this like, I mean, is it giving too much away? This is definitely comes up. And in fact, you know what? Let me just give credit where credit's due to the person who asked this. The question of like, well, who else could it have been? What other DNA could have been tested? What other fingerprints could have been important would go towards whether or not there was a second person that anyone cared to wonder if there, you know, there's, we hear that there's a conversation between two people that's happening at the first crime scene, at least the first crime scene is, you know, as we've discussed it. How did anyone care about that? Like, or was it like, one person said they did it, and if they didn't implicate anyone else, then I guess he must have figured out how to do it.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? And that's the thing. And no, like somebody asked last week, like they said, there's two voices. Was there anybody else convicted? Nope. Again, they weren't like, there's no indication in this record that the Gary Police Department ever cared about figuring out who actually killed these five people. It seems like what they cared about was closing their case and moving on. And that's what they did. But as we're going to hear, as we move along, very much like we heard from Angelique Bell in the season 15 case, what I've already heard is the streets know. The streets know who did it.
That's a big question. Maliha, I want to give you that credit. Yeah, Maliha said, we know the 24-hour thing happened. Was there consideration of more suspects? And then Maliha also says, is there any evidence like tire tracks in the snow that there were two vehicles? It sounds plausible, but wouldn't that leave some evidence?
It should. Again, like, as I talked about in the case, like that's why this crime scene is so frustrating. You heard the part of, like, I read the whole exchange of when they were talking about the footprints. Like, oh, I don't know. There was a lot. Two sets? Three? I don't know. There was a lot. It was hard to tell because they were starting to melt. That was it. It like, really? Like, there was, like, where's the pictures of them? Surely, yeah. Even if they melted, if they're melting, that means, yeah, there may not be a clear impression in the snow, but there would be in the mud underneath the snow. You know, like, where are they? I don't know. Was it tire tracks? Again, yeah, you can see in the crime scene photos, there's snow on the ground, patches of snow. The car's pulled into what was a snowy area. How many sets of tire tracks are there? Don't know. Because, again, they certainly don't want to present to the jury that there might have been another car there.
But that makes it sound like they, so even while the actual crime scene investigation, just have a very, very, very initial process of taking photographs, they already had their suspect then. That's not 24 hours. That's like right away that they should be taking those pictures and stuff.
I have to check the timeline because this is all stuff we'll dig into, but I want to say that they already had Chris being interrogated by the time these bodies were discovered or shortly after.
Which is kind of like the Jody thing, right? It's like before they barely had even looked at the crime scene, it was like, someone's saying Jody did this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we also don't know, like, were there more photos and they just weren't put in the file? The inconvenient ones were taken out? I don't know. I have a hard time. I don't know anything about Bertozzi, but I have a hard time believing that an experienced crime scene investigator would do this piss poor of a job of documenting the scene with pictures.
Well, think about, I mean, you talk about being piss poor on documenting. Think about the shoes, where he says there's only one shoe, right? In all his documents, he says there's one shoe, which is very strange. And clearly in the photos, there are two shoes. You can see them.
Yeah, well, he did in his testimony mention the other shoe. It's just weird the way he mentions it.
Okay,
you know, it's like he talks about a shoe that, like, it does differentiate if you read the testimony in there about there being two shoes. But he does. But what's weird about him is that he doesn't like make a connection to Sheila, who's shoeless. You know, it's like, we don't know who these shoes are. Like, I have a guess. You find two women's shoes next to a dead woman with no shoes on. Who do you?
I guess the generous interpretation of that is that he assumes that anybody listening will draw that conclusion, so you don't have to say that out loud.
I don't know. I will point out that he's very careful in his testimony. So I put a lot of the blame of the confusion of this scene on the prosecutor, because Bertozzi just like doesn't offer anything more. Like if the prosecutor had asked, do you have any indication who that shoe belongs to? Like, what size is the shoe? What size shoes does Sheila wear? You know, there's a lot of different ways, but it's like it just doesn't come up, because it was never like, no one ever tried to really figure out what happened at this scene. It was like, it feels very much like, boy, this is a big confusing scene. Thank God we already got a confession. We don't have to worry about it, is what it feels like.
Right. Rebecca asked whether or not Michelle was alive. Now we know that sadly she has passed away. Michelle, of course, being someone who could potentially provide valuable information on Sheila and Liz. But she did also ask, Rebecca asked, did Michelle know Amp, Angela, or Suzanne?
We're gonna get into all that. I don't think Michelle did know. I'm just gonna wait to get into it, because it's a very ambiguous, squishy. It's like a testimony of one person that maybe makes a connection, but that same person maybe already gave some other unreliable testimony. So it's like it's hard to know.
Okay. Teresa, talking a little bit more about the crime scene, Teresa says, I'm confused by the placement of Liz. She had abrasions on her back and there was a blood trail from being dragged, but ended up face down. Do you think they flipped her over for some reason and then shot her again?
You have to remember how dynamic these crime scenes are. So it may not be as something as deliberate as, okay, let's flip her over. She very well still been able to move, trying to crawl away. Could have been just, you know, dragged to a point and then just, you know, fling the body up. And that's just the way the body came to rest. So it's really hard to answer that and to know. And that's and we're going to get into that in this week's episode or next week's episode, I guess it is, the medical evidence. You really have to have a good understanding that crime scenes are dynamic. So for example, we're going to be talking a lot in that episode about like bullet trajectories. You know, it's like, so you'll see like a trajectory that goes, I'll give an example, Amp or Anthony had a gunshot wound that like went in like right in front of his earlobe and then ended up in his neck. And the trajectory is like straight down. It's almost straight down, inward a little bit. And so like you think about that and like, well, does somebody shoot him from the ceiling? And that's kind of what I mean, right? So like you got to remember bodies move, you know, if he's like sitting in a chair, crouched down, turning his head, trying, you know, flinching away from a shot or something. And, you know, there's just a lot of those types of dynamics you have to consider in any type of positioning like this.
Got it. Susan would like to know if rape kits were done on Liz and Sheila.
Yes. And we'll get into those later.
Okay. Yeah. I wish I would have saved that as the last question. Colin says, was testing done to establish whose blood it was by the dugout and the car?
Not before trial, I don't believe.
Caroline says, do we know, again, this is going towards the medical evidence, so feel free to say, put a pin in it, but do we know if any trace materials were found in the head wound? Splinters, paint, etc. Any chance she was hit by a bat that was left in the dugout? Without seeing the wound or the ME sketch, it's hard to know what oval means in terms of a wound. Would like to know if anything was found in or near the head wound, or if they even checked.
We will be getting into that in the autopsy episode, but also I don't believe there was any kind of trace evidence found in the wound. I will say that I don't think that a bat is feasible because, oval, I mean, there's pretty specific ways described. It's like 1 inch wide, 1.5 inch long, oval shapes around it on the edges, you know, around it. I don't think a bat could make that wound. You know, like I mentioned, that does, you know, fit the a lot of handles of pistols. But it could be a lot of things, any kind of, you know, tubular object, you know, anything like that, that's rounded, that's about, you know, an inch wide, basically could have made it, especially if something's like curved, you know, so like has a 90 degree angle. If you picture like a 1 inch tube bent at a 90 degree angle, like a, I'm trying to think of an example, like
tire iron.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a tire iron. Yeah. A tire iron is a possibility, or like one of those, like, those things they put on cars for like security.
You know, oh, the club?
Like the club. Yeah. Like something like that.
I think, you know, that's what it's called.
Yeah. It could be any, you know, anything like that. To me, I was just like, as soon as I saw 1 inch by 1.5 inch oval, I'm like, oh, that sounds like the handle of a gun.
Sarah is asking how far the nearest resident from where the murders most likely occurred. I think we sort of did see that in the
Yeah, in the diagram.
In the diagram.
It's right across
and,
the street.
Yeah. And her thinking on that is wondering if, you know, what would the shots have sounded like? Could they have been mistaken for something else? I would add, is this a community where you might hear gunshots and not, you know, necessarily react to it as, oh, this is a big deal? Or, you know, some areas people go target shooting, like stuff like that, or they're, you know.
Well, it wouldn't be target shooting, but we, especially not that time of night, we talked about this quite a bit ad nauseum and kind of last week. But we were talking about shots fired from inside of a house and how much that would dampen the sound coming out. These are out in the open, so they would be louder. But again, the you know anybody hearing them would be inside of an insulated house, so it would be dampened a little bit. But you would definitely hear the pops. But again, if you're awake, it's 1:30 or so in the morning, you know, I don't think it would be loud enough necessarily to like wake somebody up out of a dead sleep. But it did wake somebody up. Remember in episode one, someone did call and report the shots. What's not clear is if they called and reported the shots, and it will become clear because we'll go through that testimony. But someone did report hearing those shots. I don't believe they called them in that night though, because there's a range. I think they say 1:20 to 1:40 in the morning. They heard them, and I think it would be more specific if it was like a call right then.
Sarah also asked, what evidence is there that the clothing was removed before the murder instead of after the murder?
We'll get into that in the autopsy too, because it's going to go through like the clothing. So because ways we'll be able to tell is, for example, Liz was shot in the chest. And really, that's probably because the rest of the shots are all injuries are all to the head other than the drag marks. Obviously, she had her shirt off before she was drugged or dragged. I never know which one of those is the right one to say. But, you know, that's the one you could tell was her shirt on when she was shot, because there'll be holes in the shirt. And we'll talk about all that in the autopsy episode.
Okay. JC says, I'm confused by the officer's conduct at the scene. Bob explained it as not wanting to disturb the crime scene, but at the point of arrival, there was no known crime scene. Caution could also explain it. It just felt like a lack of urgency to discover the basis for the call. There was, by my understanding, potential victims that could be in need of medical assistance. This is compounded by no good pictures, nonsensical measurements, and an overall lack of urgency in conducting interviews, etc., even after the scene was secured. It's probably nothing, but I would just expect more from a seasoned PD. They treated Sheila and Liz like throwaways from the second the call came in.
I agree. To the beginning of that, so and that was kind of the discussion we were having earlier. According to Triggs, the witness, he saw the car and bodies, or a part of a body. So, you know, I assume the dispatch would have, but again, there's that weird thing where it seemed like they were surprised by finding the bodies. But I would assume that if that information was relayed through the dispatch, that they would be approaching it as a crime scene. And also, you know, they found blood right away. You know, as they start walking, if you look at the diagram, as they walk from the street, they get by the dugouts and there's blood on the ground already.
The last thing I have is from Donna, and it is a long, helpful, interesting explication, kind of expanding maybe or supplementing on the conversation that you guys had about the guns and how much or little you can tell from things like bullets. I don't know if you want to get into that or if you want to kind of save that. She's just kind of telling us more about the 38 caliber family, what it includes, and how many different types of 38s
Yeah, Donna made a good point, and rather than read through that whole thing, we'll just talk about, because Zach and I were just talking about this where we came in, and you know, we were looking at, oh, it's a 38, so it's a 38 special or a 357, and Donna's post there kind of reminded me and kind of spurred the conversation that we kind of forget that those aren't the only two options. You know, because they say 38, we're thinking 38, but there's a lot of different guns that could be, which kind of changes things a little bit. You know, we have, you know, there's the 38 special. Would you say the 38 Smith and Wesson 380 automatic, which is a very small, right? Again, the bullet is, so what we mean by this is the bullet is the same size for all of these. The difference is the casing and the amount of gunpowder behind it. So a 38 special is kind of a long round. It's got a decent amount of gunpowder. A 357 Magnum is even longer and has more gunpowder, more powerful. A 380 is a very, very short round, has very little gunpowder behind it, and so much slower velocity, doesn't go, you know, not as powerful of a round. A 9mm is also a 38 caliber that's a little bit bigger than a 380. So there's a lot more to it. And when we were talking, this is the part I guess we'll get in, because I was still wondering, like, what are we thinking about shot capacity? And we talked a little bit again, like, are we still, is there any possibility this wasn't a revolver? And I think Zach and I both came to the same conclusion. I just don't think it could possibly be a semi-automatic weapon.
After looking, knowing that they did not find any spent shell casings and seeing those pictures of the scene, there's no way that you're going to be able to police every shell casing that came out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's too many nooks and crannies, there's blankets and under the couch, and you would spend more time trying to find the spent shell casings,
right,
than to commit the entire crime itself. And it just doesn't seem plausible when you're trying to get away.
Yeah. And also, even if we look separately at the ball field crime scene, that's outdoors,
mm-hmm,
with snow on the ground.
Yeah.
In the dark.
Yeah.
And you got to realize with a semi-automatic gun, when you shoot it, the round ejects out and just goes, it's just somewhere off and to the right.
Yeah.
And when in the indoor crime scene, you're bouncing off walls, couches, there's blankets all over the place. There's just a mess in that living room. Like, to go and try and find all those when you're moving through a room shooting just seems completely impossible. And then outside, even worse, because you take a shot and in the dark, that shell casing flips out and like hits the snow, and there's just a teeny little spot in the snow where it went in, and then that's it. It's gone. Like, there's just no way. So,
well, and I think the listener also brought up the idea of possibly a shell catcher, which is like, they have these little bags that kind of go on the side of a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that you're using one of those in a crime. Even, I mean, they're pain in the butt to use, first of all.
I've heard of them.
They get in the way. They make the gun unreliable because they can cause the gun to jam. There's a ton of problems with them. And they're just not like readily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just don't feel like.
Can you go to I've never seen one. Like, can you just go to any old gun store and get one of those?
Probably not any old gun store, but you could probably pick out five gun stores and find one.
They would have one.
Yeah. Okay. 'Cause it's just a very uncommon thing. Like, it's not something that people use a lot.
Yeah. And I guess the last thing that I want to address is something that somebody, I don't remember if it was on this thread and just didn't get included because of the way it was formatted, or if it was just in another post, but somebody had asked, based on kind of the end of the episode, so are we already now saying, am I saying and concluding that these two crime scenes are connected? And I just want to make clear, I'm not. But, you know, when I worked through the hypothesis based on what we know at this point, it was kind of a light bulb moment for me was, you know, and it is very, very, it's not even a profile, it's just a preliminary behavioral analysis of the scene was, okay, now I can see that there was a significant effort put into concealing this crime scene. And so then the way that behavioral analysis works is then to say, okay, why? It's all about why, right? Why did this behavior happen? What reason would someone have to conceal the crime like this, temporarily, to buy them some time? And the only reason that usually scenes like this that I could come up with is they would need time to either get the hell out of town and get long and far away from this. But if that's the case, I still don't think you conceal it, because I think you just as easily jump in your car and drive away if nobody knows you. Mm-hmm. The only reason that I can think of that they would put the effort into concealment would be that they have a known, and don't confuse this when I say known personal relationship to the victim. That doesn't mean that they're like old friends. That doesn't mean that they have, you know, that this doesn't look like a personal cause homicide. But what I mean by that is that either someone knows that they were with, that this person was with these victims that night, or they at least think someone knows that there's a person or persons who think they were with them that night. And so
it's just that they could have been seen
right
with them, not necessarily like.
So, and that was kind of, I'll jump all the way back to like the West Memphis 3 case. You know, we don't have any good witnesses that say, I saw this person go across that pipe bridge with those boys. But there was an incredible effort put into trying to conceal those bodies so that they were never discovered. So again, it's why. Then you look at where they came through. As it turned out, no one said in that apartment complex, the Mayfair apartments that were right there, no one said, yeah, I saw this guy walking with those kids. But the offender wouldn't know that. If the offender walked across that bridge and there's an apartment building right there full of people that had a clear view of that bridge,
yeah,
then in the moment, then after the murders happen, they have to think, oh no, someone could have seen me with them, so I need to hide these bodies. It's kind of that type of thing, right?
Right.
So in this case, if we jump to, okay, they put effort into concealing it. So these weren't, to me, that tells me these weren't random strangers that no one knows is with these ladies, because I think they just leave. They just get out of there.
Right. But they don't move her car. I just think that's interesting.
Well, moving the car is taking even more risk and more time.
Yeah. But, you know, sometimes people do. Sometimes it's right. Like, I'm going to separate the vehicle because the vehicle is this big clunky thing that's just in the middle of this area and like drive it across town and take that huge risk, too.
Right. Yeah. There's definitely like, and again, this is where you get into, too, like what, you know, like how clearly were they thinking? What was the panic? You know, what was going on right then? But the best I came up with was that based on the behaviors that we see exhibited at this crime scene regarding concealment, that the reason for that kind of concealment, I think likely means that someone knew that they were with those girls. So then now I'm looking at the state has connected these two crime scenes. And so I just apply that kind of knowledge to that. And it's like, okay, so how could they be connected up till that point? Because prior to really breaking down the diagram and figuring out how this concealment happened, it looked to me from looking at the pictures like, oh, they just pulled back there with these women. There was some kind of sexual assault and they murdered them and got out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, how does the same two people or same three people or same whoever or many people go do that? And then they're like, you know what? Let's go kill some more people somewhere. Like the MOs at the two crime scenes are so different, they don't make sense. But could they make sense if people, and I don't know the answer to this, I'm not like being coy with you, but if the people at that house knew that they were with those two women at the ballpark, now it makes that scenario, that hypothetical scenario, makes sense to me. That if they would have left and said, oh crap, the people at that house know we were with them. They're going to find these bodies tomorrow. Somebody's going to find them at some point, and they're going to know it was us. We need to go take care of that. Ooh, so I'm not saying that's
such a massive risk, too, to be like, let's go end more people's lives and being seen there, you know.
And you look at the brutality of the house crime scene, too, and it's and you know, this is, we're getting into a profile before we have all the information, so I don't want to do that, but it's screaming to me, this is a violent person. This is someone who has a violent history. They didn't think twice about going in, and you know, and we already kind of knew that just from the fact that there's an 18-month-old kid there that didn't faze them from doing what they did. So with all that being said, we'll go ahead and wrap this thing up. And again, so just to remind you, this Sunday, there's no episode. If you're a patron, you can join the live stream with Janet and I on Sunday through the Patreon app. That will be at 1 p.m. Eastern time, 10 p.m. or 10 a.m. Pacific time on Sunday. And for everybody else, or if you're just not available to join the live stream and you are a patron, that conversation will drop as an episode, as just a normal full episode, next Friday. So 1 week from today, and then that following Sunday, then we're going to cover the autopsy. So what we're going to do now that we know what the jury heard about these crime scenes, is now we're really going to do what we do. We're going to pick it apart. We're going to look at every element of the medical evidence. We're going to be talking about, you know, gunshot trajectories and different in toxicology reports, and try to get a much better perspective of what happened to the victims. And then moving forward, then we're going to go into a full detailed in-depth crime scene analysis, doing things like, sorry, I forgot which listener it was, but the one that pointed out like things like the car seat pushed up. And, you know, that's the type of work we do next, is start to look at, okay, what do we think happened, as opposed to accepting the narrative from the state. That's all coming up in the next few weeks. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Thanks everybody for listening. And thank you everybody for all of your support. And we'll talk to you guys next week on Friday, where you're going to hear all about Janet and I's take on the undisclosed discoveries in the Anansi Ed case. So we'll see you then.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.